Hello. Today we're joined by Stacey Havener of Havener Capital. Now, Stacey's job is to raise assets for boutique fund managers, and to date she's raised 8 billion. You might know Stacey from LinkedIn, where she is a prolific poster, followed by many in the asset management industry. Stacey's also been writing for Citywire Selector, specifically our Inside Asset Management newsletter, with her tips for people in distribution. So, hello, Stacey.
Hello, Will. Thank you for having me in the studio.
My pleasure. So, Stacey, tell us a bit more about yourself and what you do.
Okay, happy to. So you are right. I am the founder of Havener Capital. I've raised $8 billion for boutiques, new funds, startups, firms that really shouldn't win. You're right about all that, and yet none of it makes any sense. And I am a blue-collar kid from a working-class town who got the wrong degree from the wrong school. And so in many ways, I think part of my passion in helping boutiques is that I don't make a lot of sense in this industry either, and yet here we are. The secret to all of the capital-raising success over years of unpacking it is really two things. People do business with people. And story is what people buy. Those two things are what most asset managers miss, whether they're boutiques or bigs.
Okay.
Okay, before we go any further in the interview, can I turn the tables and ask you a question?
Okay.
Okay, because at lunch I asked you this question, and I actually think it would be really helpful for people to get the backstory, if you will, of Salescraft. So
Yeah.
could you share that with
Yeah,
us?
yeah. So, we'll do my distribution content, and we've got interviews with people from distribution. That's all great. But I've been at Citywire for a while. I've been since Citywire since 2010. I spent 10 or so years of that at New Model Advisor working with financial planners. And we did a lot on the profession of financial planning, what it is to do that job. And for the people who are really good at it, there was a lot of thought in that went into that client conversation, that between the planner and the client, and of peeling back the layers. I've gone through this process myself. I've written about it, and it's really important, and it's a really learned practice thing to be able to listen the right way, to ask the right questions, to peel back that layers and get to the center of what's going on. So when it came to talking to people in fund distribution, you start to understand their challenges and what's going on. You think, yeah, this is another, it's another profession. It is a job in its own right with its own challenges. There's a process going on here. So trade journalism, any time in history, any day of the week, it's a good idea to be asking these questions. Like, how do you do your job? Someone's really good at it. They might be getting paid more because they're so good at it. So what makes people good? Now, I think what happened at the same time was that these messages were coming through from the conversations I was having, which were, well, sales is changing. Oh, it's not sales anymore, it's distribution. The client's changing, the tables are turned, it's harder. Markets are difficult, we can't get the flow. So that straight away, that question of what makes that person good is also changing. So that's, that really put front and center this idea of that what how do you do your job really well? Now, one of the first things we did, myself and my colleague Noor at Citywire, was put together an article where we thought, let's talk to some selectors. So let's ask the client, the fund selector,
Brilliant.
what they think of sales. What do you, to try and get to the heart, to try and get some sort of inroad into this question, what do the clients think? So we asked them, and we wrote this article. It was something like, listen more, call less. So, what selectors hate about sales or something like that. Maybe not hate, but it was what they want to improve about sales. And that did great. It got great reads, got great engagement. LinkedIn did well on LinkedIn. And people were saying, we'd like to have a bit more of this. So throughout sort of those last 2 years, I've tried to ask selectors this question when I can. what do you like about sales approaches? How do people get a meeting with you? What don't you like? What works?
Yeah.
And you're starting to get some messages through. So in Selector this year, we started sort of doing a few articles where people would respond to some of those things. I think there was a memorable one about don't do a meeting for the meeting's sake. So often
that was a great one.
Salesperson yes. would be in town.
Yes.
So they say, hey, I'm in town, let's meet. And for that client, for that selector, it was sort of rung really hollow. And, you know, it totally makes sense. As a journalist, I'd do the same thing, right?
Yeah.
But it was just really great to hear from someone who said, look, I know sales. I know clients. I know what works. And this is not a good idea. And here's why.
Yeah.
And so it's sort of counterintuitive. It's counter to a lot of what was going on, you know. And I have spoken to, you know, friends, you know, people I know from outside of the asset management industry who work in sales in different industries. And, you know, sometimes there's a little bit surprised.
Yeah.
A little bit surprised, you know, they're doing something slightly different already in their industry. And, you know, I think there was something there. So then we met.
Yeah.
Probably on LinkedIn,
yes.
virtually. And obviously, it sort of, you know, we started having conversations about this. And I decided to call this stream of content, the stream of thought, sales craft.
Love it.
I love the idea.
It's so
like
good.
It's like you're, you know, there's an artisanal aspect
yes.
to it. But there's an aspect of there are things you can learn, the things you can think about that will improve your outcomes.
Yes.
And, you know, look, you know, everyone's got a set of KPIs, right? But, I'm constantly getting these messages from the people I interview saying, it's not about the hard sell anymore. It's about listening to the client. So, yes, those KPIs are probably still at some point based on AUM or something like that. But there's loads more that's going into that. And mm-hmm. anyway, how are you getting that AUM?
Yeah.
And it's not, you know, you're not going to be able to kind of make someone, trick someone into doing
yes.
something. These are cool customers. You know, everyone knows this. How are you kind of going to cut through? The competition's intense.
Very.
Selectors are working with more asset managers than ever, they tell us. That's an always surprising thing to the asset managers and to the salespeople, because they think, no, they're not. But it's probably because the competition's so high, or you're not getting as big a slice, or you're losing more than you're winning compared to a few years ago. These problems are really important. They're really important for the industry. It, you know, in some quarters, an industry that can sometimes get a bit of a kicking. So, you know, I think it seems like an important thing to do, and it's kind of what I want to do is trade journalism. Yeah.
I mean, I love it. I am the choir, so you're preaching to me, obviously. But, you know, let's jump in. There's two things you said there. I want to talk about KPIs specifically, because this is, I agree with the concept of sales is a craft. It is a profession. There is a way to do sales that works. And then there are probably lots of ways to do it and lots of ways that don't, right? But KPIs is something we all want to measure, because there needs to be some leading indicator to the assets, and be great if it was objective and quantitative and could be measured every week. But there's a really big problem with KPIs. KPIs measure what the salesperson does, and that is less relevant by a lot than what the prospect does. So if your KPI is how many dials you made, how many emails you sent, and all this stuff, does that actually predict assets? What if you're really bad at emails and voicemails? Then no, it's actually maybe a counter indicator of assets, because you're pissing everybody off. Really, what you want to be able to capture is not what is the salesperson doing, although they have to be doing activities. It's what is the buyer doing.
Okay.
Think about that. And so for us, one of the things we look at is, has this prospect sent you an unsolicited email requesting something?
Okay.
Because if the prospect sends you an email and says, hey, Will, can you send me, you know, historical return file going back to blah, blah, blah. Or I want all the commentaries, and specifically I want them from 08 because I want to see what the team was thinking. The sort of behavioral tell of that activity is leaps and bounds more valuable than how many fact sheets your salesperson sent out. And so the KPI mechanism is quite broken because it's measuring what the salesperson does.
How interesting.
Yeah.
What it reminds me of the, you know, an interview I've just done where they talked a lot about the fact that selling was sort of over. It's about buying now. And that's why they had to deliver so many, so much sort of bespoke funds, bespoke strategies. But also that, you know, it's the whole team's effort. And so you're trying to spread those KPIs around product team, marketing, so on. But it feels like almost that's right. But there's still this other part of the picture, which is that's trying to draw out what the client is doing.
Right. That's another broken piece that you alluded to, which is if you think about what the craft of sales has been up until now, in an environment when assets were sort of sloshing around pretty, you know, easily for lots of people, the way that you practice sales was what? It was pitching. It was talking at someone. So it was, you know, the trainings of like, tell them what you're going to tell them, you tell them, and then you tell them what you told them, right? And all of that is one direction, me talking at you. When the reality of how it works is bi-directional, it's conversation, not presentation. And that's a totally different skill set. So sort of like the stand and deliver or the dog and pony show or this feeling that like, oh, you know, Will agreed to meet with me. I've got him, you know, for 30 minutes. I'm going to make him sit through 40 slides about stuff that the allocator doesn't care about. That's dead. That's dead. And if that is the way that asset managers are still selling because it was the old way, it won't work. And I think they're feeling that.
Yeah. So this is the topic of your first piece that you wrote for us. Ditch the pitch.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Yes. Yep.
Look it up. Yes. Exclusively on City of Our Selector.
That's right.
But that was about not talking about your fund or not talking about your asset manager. It was sort of resisting the temptation to talk about yourself.
Yes.
Certainly for a long time in that meeting.
Well, if you believe that human behavior sort of underlies everything, which I very much do, that sort of behavioral finance and behavioral economics does drive decision making and the exchange of money, then the studies would tell you that for an allocator to think the meeting was a good meeting, they need to talk 70% of the time.
Right.
But what was happening when the stand and deliver sort of vibe was going on? That wasn't happening. The allocator was sitting there listening to you talk at them. So for them to think it's a good meeting, the whole thing needs to be reversed, which means you actually have to be very good at asking questions and listening to the answer. Because the clues you will get just as a human asking questions, if I ask you, Will, what's on your research radar right now? And then I stop talking, you will tell me. And if I ask another question which says, oh, interesting, you have a search in that, like what's important to you in that search? You will talk again. So even granular on actual searches, that works. But for me, what precedes all of that is just sort of the human piece, which is to say, is someone buying a fund or a strategy, or are they buying a person? Are they hiring a human or buying a fund? And I think that's debatable, but I know where I stand on that, which is they're hiring a human.
When this came up, we published some research the other week, and it was something like, it was based on a poll that we'd done at our event, and it was saying 30% of selectors would buy a fund without ever meeting the manager. You know, is this a surprise? And it was interesting seeing the comments, because one of the first comment was, well, yeah, quite right. You know, what's personality and fluff got to do with it?
Oh,
and then, you know, then there's some other comments came in saying, oh, but hang on, there's sort of something to this.
Yes.
And, you know, anyone who's been in those conversations realizes that, you know, it has been typical for the selectors themselves to say that they really required this sort of in-person meeting for these sort of questions they wanted to answer. So I suppose, what do you make of that, if that's at all a trend? I suppose putting onto to you, what is the justification of in-person meetings? You know, is it taking away from the real hard stuff, or is it an opportunity for selectors to gain something more truthful and useful for their clients?
Yeah, it's such a great question. And look, I think this idea of fluff around narrative is pervasive because it feels like spin. But if we sort of say, like, no one's out here trying to, like, pull one, you know, pull a fast one, or, you know, like, people are here to do business together if it makes sense for both parties and they're coming from a good place. So if that is sort of the rule, then 95% of any decision, any buying decision, is subconscious. 95% is subconscious. What happens in our industry, because everyone is so smart and so intellectual and lives up here, is that we aim our pitch and our sales messaging at their brain, and we're missing the buyer. So if that is true, which I can tell you from my experience it is, then we're missing the most critical part that has to happen first, which is the heart has to buy first, and then the brain has to rationalize the decision, which means the numbers still matter a lot. It's just not what should lead the conversation. So the strategy that we teach clients is story-led, data-backed. So the reverse is how most asset managers pitch.
How interesting. And I guess that brings on to a topic that we also discussed at lunch.
Yes.
Which is differentiation.
Oh, yes.
Because that would fall into that category of something that is very important. Mm-hmm. It's what distribution professionals, sellers want to talk about. Mm-hmm. It's what buyers like to talk about. Selectors always say they're on the hunt for this stuff. But it's, you know, how would that be expressed in the literature, the marketing, or even in the numbers themselves? It's a sort of deeper thing. You could write it down. Mm-hmm. That does seem like something that is crucially something that that takes place or is understood within the settings of a conversation. But
absolutely. Yeah. Well, differentiation, you can differentiate with numbers, but let's talk about what that might look like. Because I think that's probably, again, in our industry, it's a numbers industry. And I solidly sit here as a words girl in an industry full of numbers guys. So I realize that this is counterintuitive. But this is a words exercise. So we're going to keep that to the side. We're going to say, if you approached it from a numbers perspective, then if you wanted to differentiate in a positive way, you would sell performance that is beating something. I'm different because I'm ahead. I'm different because I have more alpha or less standard deviation. Throw whatever stats salad you want together about how you're better, right? And that is how you're going to be different. But different is better than better. Because if you sell better, especially as it relates to numbers, and the numbers change, which happens to every fund manager, you have periods of outperformance in periods where you lag. If you sell the outperformance as your differentiator, then when it disappears, guess what happens? You get sold.
You got nothing.
They redeem because that's what they bought. So instead of doing that, again, like, it's going to come back around, but if we switch gears over to the narrative side, to the word side, then you would look for differentiators that are forever differentiators, not fleeting differentiators.
Right.
So forever differentiators would be things that don't change. The way that we help clients get to that would be, it's because it's very difficult. When you say, like, what makes you different? It's like, it's really, really difficult to get there. So what we encourage clients to do is say, okay, tell us something that your peers do or believe that you don't. So it's almost in the inverse. Instead of saying what makes you different in a positive way, tell us something that all your peers do and you don't. All your peers believe and you don't. And let's talk about that thing, what you stand against or what you disagree with, it from a philosophy perspective or a process perspective, because that's not going to change. And if people buy that, then even when your performance might face some headwinds, they're more inclined to stay.
Brilliant. One thing I want to ask, just classic mistakes.
Yeah.
We've covered a few areas, but is there anything else that you've seen that you could point out now that would be just one of those all-time sort of classic universal things?
I mean, the biggest mistake, in my opinion, that we make in sales in general is we view it as a zero-sum game.
Okay.
So it's in order for me to win, you have to lose. I'm so sorry, Will. But if I'm going to win, you're going to lose. In order for me to get into the portfolio, I have to knock you out.
Yeah.
And so that vibe is pretty aggressive, right? There's a lot of things that happen when you take that stance, not the least of which is if you're speaking to an allocator who has that fund in their lineup, they either love it now or loved it once. And if you start trashing it, that is just not a good look in any way, shape, or form. So I would say a classic mistake is the sort of the competing mindset versus the complementing mindset. So if you were the fund manager, instead of trying to knock you out of the portfolio, I could instead try to show how adding my fund into the mix makes the whole thing better. Will and his fund are great, and they're great at this. But let's go back to our forever differentiator. They do a lot of, they believe this, we believe this other thing. When they zig, we zag. And so actually, when you have the two of us, it's pretty magical. Do you see the difference? If I'm trying to, you know, elbow you out of the portfolio, or if I'm just trying to come in alongside you. That is a classic mistake. And by the way, that is something you can show quantitatively in a very powerful way.
Okay.
Very powerful way.
Brilliant.
Yeah.
All right. Well, I think we've got some good tips there.
Good, I hope.
I think everyone needs to look out for your next piece.
Yes, it's going to be on differentiation, spoiler alert.
So, Inside Asset Management newsletter, get it every Thursday for CityWire Selector. But for now, Stacey, thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.